you want to find out the actual meaning of all those things, it's pretty easy to look up. There is a lot of websites out there. There are a lot of websites that tell that. I didn't obviously make that, you know, information up for myself. I found it easily. Okay. So one of the most important stories about Christmas is A Christmas Carol. And I have a article that's in the Catholic Family News. It's actually going to be reprinted tomorrow, I think. I think we do a reprint of it tomorrow at Life Site. I can't remember. A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens is far and away one of the greatest Christmas stories. It really is. And there's a lot of reasons for that. It also, I mean, one of the main reasons, I'm actually looking at the, it's on my shelf right now, I can see it. Charles Dickens was a really troubled man. He really was. I think he had a lot of problems in his life. So it's kind of like, and I'll talk about this in the essay I'm about to read, but it's kind of like he's the perfect person to write the tale of basically seeing a life of sinful misery, which causes other people misery, because, you know, it's an allegory for kind of the sort of person he was. And it's an astonishing story. If you haven't read, a lot of people have never read it. I mean, you've seen the story 100 times, whether it's a cartoon or an old movie, or you've, you know, it's been adapted 25 different ways. If you haven't seen it before or read it before, I recommend, you can find a PDF if you got a Kindle. It's free. It's one of those old books. We got an old copy of it in a Charles Dickens Christmas collection. And it's amazing. It really is amazing. Charles Dickens is a fascinating figure too. I mean, novels, as we understand them, are not that, they're not a very old thing. Stories are old. You can go back and, you know, Chaucer and Beowulf and Dante and that sort of thing. Fine. But this idea that you would have people who were writers who would print things that were for popular consumption, that is pretty modern thing. This idea that you'd have, you know, books that would be printed and bound so that the average person could pick them up at a stand and read them, that's not something that goes back too far in history. Not even close, and it doesn't go back to the beginning of the printing press either, because, you know, there were still costs associated with materials and things that made it impossible. But Charles Dickens is, in some ways, you know, kind of like Vivaldi was almost one of the first musician stars, in a sense. Charles Dickens is, I mean, there's probably other people similar, but he's kind of like the first bestseller novelist, you know, because also too, this idea that you could be a writer without also being like a professor, or a priest. A lot of good writers were priests and or Anglican ministers and things. You know, this idea that like you were just a writer. That's obviously a newspaper thing, okay? But it's also sort of a modern novel thing. So it's not that old of a, it's, I mean, a couple hundred years old, maybe 300 years maximum. But Charles Dickens is kind of like the first major novelist, at least in the English-speaking world, that sort of gives us this bestseller experience. It's amazing. It's amazing to see it's amazing to see the level of literature drop. I mean, Charles Dickens wrote this story, which so many people today would have a hard time reading fast, reading without a lot of trouble. And he was writing for a popular audience. Anyway, it's an amazing story. And I wrote an essay, that I think you'll enjoy. And it's one of the things that I'm most proud of, not going to lie. Okay, and here it is. And it's in the Catholic Family News for this month. So if you have an online subscription to them, you can read it. But also, I believe it's going to be every year at LifeSite, because we always take holidays. You know, we're all Christians, so we take some time off. We have a bunch of Christmas reflections that are reprinted or published on, I think, the 24th, so tomorrow. And my essay will be there. It's called A Christmas Carol, Reading Dickens with Chesterton as Guide. And here it goes. A Christmas classic. Without a doubt, we have all read or heard or watched a rendition of A Christmas Carol, the classic English novella by Charles Dickens. Whether in a cartoon or a play or a Hollywood production, or by reading a children's version of the story, we can all call to mind the story about the ghosts of Christmas past, present, and future. Our common parlance in all of the English-speaking world knows exactly what is meant when someone is labeled a Scrooge. Popular authors who seek to transmit the true meaning of Christmas in their works are often only able to imitate a Dickens-esque motif, wherein a miser comes to find the true meaning of the Christian celebration through some sort of interior conversion. The famous Dr. Seuss story, The Grinch Who Stole Christmas, is perhaps nothing more than a whimsical rendition of the same theme set out by the great English author a century prior. It might seem a bit of a stretch to some, but I believe the argument could be made that we see shades of Dickens in the classic film It's a Wonderful Life. Themes of childhood trauma, greed, and financial obsession, and inevitable conversion brought on by a preternatural visitor who helps the protagonist see the real reason for the season, are paramount in both stories. In addition, the depths of human despair and the brink of nihilistic suicidal ideation are palpable as we watch George Bailey see a glimpse of life without his existence, just as we see Ebenezer Scrooge perceive the veritable contempt that so many have for him. In Frank Capra's motion picture masterpiece and in Charles Dickens' literary classic, the profundity of sadness at certain points is almost too much. Our hearts ache along with the characters as we simultaneously despise them to a degree that might only be matched by how much we come to pity their tragic lot. Enter G.K. Chesterton. Chesterton, the famous English writer and convert to the faith, wrote a biography of Dickens that T.S. Eliot said was the, quote, best on that author that has ever been written, end quote. This is high praise coming from a highly praiseworthy source. It would be a mistake for us to consider the biography that Chesterton published in 1906 as part of a postmodern biographical literature. So often in our day, biographies are written mostly like elongated encyclopedia entries, wherein the focus is on the minutia of historical factoids. This is not to say that great attention to detail is not sometimes extremely relevant and helpful, but it was not Chesterton's style, not at all. Anyone familiar with G.K. Chesterton's works will know very well that in each book, chapter, and even phrase, there is a story told that gives us a glimpse of the exuberance that filled his mind on the very idea considered. When Chesterton wrote biographies, he was not always focused on the empirical facts of a man's life as the primary means of knowing a man. Instead, he took the reader on a journey into the meaning of what meant most to the person about whom he wrote. When he published St. Francis of Assisi, for example, he went beyond what other biographers had done before him and brought us into the romance that Francis had with God's creation. Void of any earth worship nonsense that so many tragically associate with the seraphic father. And the music's going to kick me off here in just a second. So before I get caught on the cliff of a thought that I know you want me to finish, I'm going to sit here and watch this beautiful snow. It's coming down in snowflakes the size of quarters. It's amazing. You're listening to The Kennedy Profession here on the Crusade Channel. It's the last live radio station standing. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I love this song. Justin, you got to send me the actual... I've only ever heard this version of this song on our show. You got to send me that. Because it's special. I really like it. It's one of the only... Or one of the few, let's say, examples when old meets new and it actually makes something... I mean, it's not better than... I can't say it's better than Bach's original. But there is something about it that it's pretty good. Okay, so we're reading an essay here about reading A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens with G.K. Chesterton as your guide. And we just finished before the break that Chesterton wrote a biography about Dickens, and we need to understand how Chesterton writes in order to understand this biography, which is an amazing biography, which I recommend you read. When Chesterton wrote biographies, he was not always focused on the empirical facts of a man's life as the primary means of knowing a man. Instead, he took the reader on a journey into the meaning of what meant most to the person about whom he wrote. When he published St. Francis of Assisi, for example, he went beyond what other biographers had done before him and brought us into the romance that Francis had with God's creation, void of any earth worship nonsense that so many tragically associate with the seraphic father. One passage in his biography encapsulates the man in a way that only a Chestertonian prose could accomplish. Now, for St. Francis, nothing was ever in the background. We might say that his mind had no background, except perhaps that divine darkness out of which the divine love had called up every colored creature one by one. He saw everything as dramatic, distinct from its setting, not all of a piece like a picture, but in action like a play. A bird went by him like an arrow, something with a story and a purpose, though it was a purpose of life and not a purpose of death. A bush could stop him like a brigand, and indeed he was as ready to welcome the brigand as the bush. End quote. In St. Thomas Aquinas, The Dumb Ox, we find ourselves falling in love with the magnificent mind of the angelic doctor in a way that only a 20th century fun-loving English author could accomplish. One quote comes to mind that portrays the childlike wonder behind the great theologian's contemplation of God. Quote, I can hardly conceive of any educated man believing in God at all without believing that God contains in himself every perfection, including eternal joy, and does not require the solar system to entertain him like a circus. End quote. Chesterton's biography of Dickens. Chesterton wrote of Dickens before he tackled the stories of great saints. Leafing through the pages written about the progenitor of the most well-known Christmas story of the past 200 years is like being guided through a reliquary by a holy man who has a true devotion to each saint represented. It is obvious when reading the Dickens biography that Chesterton had something of an encyclopedic memory of his works, littering his phrases with timely references from any of his works with ease. It is certain that Chesterton had comprehended Dickens' style as if it were his own. There is a moment in A Christmas Carol when Ebenezer Scrooge arrives home for that fateful night of his preternatural sojourn with the ghosts that haunted his conscience. Scrooge happens upon the most mundane of things, a door knocker, but sees something so real that it must not be real at all. Dickens masterfully describes the moment in the following manner. Quote, "Now it is a fact that there was nothing at all particular about the knocker on the door, except that it was very large. It is also a fact that Scrooge had seen it night and morning during his whole residence in that place. Also that Scrooge had as little of what is called fancy about him as any man in the city of London, even including, which is a bold word, the corporation, aldermen, and livery. Scrooge, having his key in the lock of the door, saw in the knocker, without its undergoing any intermediate process of change, not a knocker, but Marley's face. Marley's face. It was not an impenetrable shadow, as the other objects in the yard were, but had a dismal light about it, like a bad lobster in a dark cellar. It was not angry or ferocious, but looked at Scrooge as Marley used to look, with ghostly spectacles turned up on its ghostly forehead. And its livid color made it horrible. But its horror seemed to be in spite of the face and beyond its control, rather than a part of its own expression." End quote. There's a certain dread that creeps up the reader's spine when entering into that eerie scene. And the uncanny nature of such an impossible event piques curiosity for a realm of things heretofore invisible. Chesterton describes the texture of the moment perfectly. Quote, "There are details in the Dickens descriptions, a window or a railing or the keyhole of a door, which he endows with demoniac life. The things seem more actual than things really are. Indeed, that degree of realism does not exist in reality. It is the unbearable realism of a dream. And this kind of realism can only be gained by walking dreamily in a place. It cannot be gained by walking observantly." End quote. Could there be a more accurate way of describing that dreadful moment in Scrooge's journey than how Chesterton describes the hyper-realism of Dickens? If my experience is any barometer, I believe I can say that there is a transportation to another literary world that takes place when following Scrooge to his home that night. It is that sort of moment that feels as mundane as buttering toast, almost unconscious, only to be interrupted by a textured shadow that fills the corner of your eye, a figure that disappears when you try and focus, but was definitely real. In Dickens' personal life, he was something of a tragic man, and his battle with his Christian conscience was something that he could never avoid. I dare not speak ill of the dead in the way that modern writers love to do, bashing the character flaws of every man who represents an older and wiser way. But it is true that he struggled with personal demons, like all of us. His Christian faith was not orthodox, and he toyed with agnostic and materialist conceptions of religion. But his psychology was as Christian as England once was. It would be too simplistic to say that Scrooge was Dickens, or that Dickens wrote Scrooge to consciously project himself. But it is a fact of literature that every good author includes a piece of his soul in his work. It is unavoidable. Bad writers are capable of leaving themselves out of their work, like the Hollywood foot soldiers who crank out vapid blockbusters that have as much depth as the computer software that creates the graphics for the film. Dickens was too honest. He was too great. He was too real not to offer his own conscience as a central theme in his work. Dickens and the Spirit of Christmas. There is something about Christmas, even more than Easter, that baptizes the secular world, even if just for a night. Please don't misunderstand what I mean. The gloominess of Good Friday and the levity of Easter are palpable. But on the night of Christ's birth, there is a triumphant expectation that accelerates when little children spring forth from their beds on that following morning of Christian mirth. Even those who have fallen away from the faith allow themselves to be Christians, if just for a few hours each December. as there is no greater song that the human heart can sing in thanksgiving for all that has been given than a Christmas carol. There are a select few who actively work against this inescapable yearning, and they find themselves miserable. There is no sadder or more darkened soul than the man who spends Christmas alone in defiance of that joy that is offered him. If only he let his tears of gratitude flow down his cheeks with the musicality of that angelic visitation to the shepherds. Scrooge is one of those men. This reality is depicted soon after he passes through the preternatural initiation of the ghostly door knocker.